Hello and welcome to Future Building. I'm Matthew Aitchison and I'm Professor at Monash University and CEO of Building 4.0 CRC. In this podcast, we take a broad look at buildings and building in contemporary society and what's coming down the pipeline in the future. We'll talk with invited guests and experts in the field, where we'll cover news and trends along with research and developments in the industry. Future Building is proudly sponsored by Building 4.0 CRC. If you've been to a conference about building at some time in the last decade, you would no doubt have seen at least one presenter talk about productivity in building, or more aptly put, the lack of productivity in building. This would likely have appeared in a graph indicating a trend, gently rolling down and to the right for construction, while the rest of the economy is trending sharply up and to the right. A few years back, this productivity slide was getting so much airtime that some of my colleagues from Stanford suggested that perhaps we needed to mandate a moratorium on its use. But productivity in building is no joke. In the last few years, it's drifted from a niche interest by a few economists and academics to a mainstream issue with very, very serious repercussions. Productivity owes its ascension to front page news to that other household topic, the housing supply and affordability crisis. In 2024, I benchmarked the housing targets of four countries that I'd recently visited: the USA, Germany, the UK, and Australia. And I found that all were missing their housing targets by at least 30% and in some cases up to 50%, which shows, I guess, that this crisis really is international. It was then a great gift that the Australian Government's Productivity Commission undertook a research paper on the topic of housing construction productivity, which was released in February 2025. The report has been really well received by industry and government here in Australia, but not because it was good news. In many ways, it just confirmed what many in the industry already had known for some time. But the paper was extremely helpful, in my opinion, because it put this really important topic squarely in the center field of public debate, and it provided solid evidence of the decline of productivity, its effects on the economy, and it offered some solutions for what could be done to improve it. Like the housing crisis, the productivity crisis is not a uniquely Australian affair. And I believe the insights we can gain from this important report are instructive to those other countries who are dealing with the same issues. To talk us through the paper and these issues, our guest today is Danielle Wood, Chair of the Australian Government's Productivity Commission. For those unfamiliar with the Commission, it's a specific government agency set up to look across the entire economy from a policy and productivity point of view. It gathers data, carries out analysis, and it makes suggestions for how we could address these shortcomings. The Commission has a cherished position in public policy. It's fiercely independent, and depending on which side of its recommendations you might fall, you might see it as a blessing or a curse. Danielle is an accomplished economist and executive. Prior to joining the Commission as chair in November 2023, she was CEO of the Grattan Institute, a really well-known Australian policy think tank with an emphasis on economic matters. Danielle studied economics and holds two master's degrees, one in economics and one in competition law. Just a couple of highlights from today's episode include how Danielle came herself to the Productivity Commission, how the fragmented nature of the construction industry is really contributing to productivity decline, the nature of the available data we have in our sector or the lack thereof, and what lessons other sectors like mining or agriculture might hold for us in building and construction. I really hope you enjoy reading the report, and I also hope you enjoy our interview. I spoke with Danielle from her home office in April 2025. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Danielle, let's start with your background and how you came to be leading the Productivity Commission. As we heard in the introduction, you studied economics and competition law. I'd like to know what led you into those areas in the first place.
So, you know, economics was probably my first love, to be honest. I studied it at high school and I immediately had a sense for why it was important. I had these great teachers that really explained how it could be used as a tool to understand the world and how that could be used in the context of policy and, you know, making government work to make the world a better place. So I was sort of immediately hooked into economics from a pretty young age. Competition law was something that I got into a bit later. I was working at the ACCC, the competition regulator, and I found myself arguing with lawyers a lot. They have a slightly different framework for thinking about the world. And so I kind of went to study law just to make myself better at arguing with lawyers. So that it's more of a sort of augmentation, but I'm really an economist first and foremost.
And I understand, not that I'm in any way an expert in economics, but I understand there are many different subdisciplines in economics. Can you frame for us where you might sit within the wider discipline?
Yeah, I mean, there's essentially kind of two major branches, which is you can think of as sort of microeconomics and macroeconomics. So macroeconomists are concerned with, questions around interest rates, trade balances, those sort of, literally macro things. Microeconomists, which is what I would identify myself as, are more interested in thinking about the performance of particular sectors, the way in which people respond to incentives. So a lot of the kind of government policy questions are actually kind of micro questions. So at the end of the day, at the Productivity Commission, even though we're concerned with these kind of bigger questions of economic performance, we delve down into particular sectors or part of the economy to understand the way that they interact and move with incentives and different policy settings.
Interesting. Yeah, I think if I could have a second bite at a career, I'd definitely go back and do economics. I find it fascinating, the
It's
more I learned about it.
amazing how many people, sort of mid-career people, say that, and it breaks my heart on one level. I used to be the president of the Economic Society here in Australia, and we struggle to get young people through the door. So we've had
Interesting.
a real challenge with declining enrolments. There's lots of great, interesting, well-paid jobs. But we've got a kind of marketing problem. I think people that find it later in life realize how exciting it can be. But we need to get that message to younger people earlier.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that's really interesting. So perhaps a career for wise heads that come to the field later in life, that would also be okay.
Absolutely. Yep. You can join Matthew. We'll have you.
Thank you. Well, I it's never stopped me from trying to sound like I might know what I'm talking about when it comes to economics. So you mentioned the ACCC. What did the journey look like from there, Danielle?
Well, actually, before the ACCC, it might be worth mentioning I started my career as a graduate at the Productivity Commission. So
Oh,
I've
fantastic.
come full circle in some senses. But so I went from the Productivity Commission to the ACCC, where I was, really interested in that question of consumer issues, how markets function, how competition can work to deliver better outcomes. I worked in consulting for a little while, and then I spent almost a decade at a think tank, Australian think tank called the Grattan Institute, which was a sort of a broad public policy think tank. And from Grattan to my current role, as I said, full circle at the Productivity Commission.
Wonderful. So I had a crack in our introduction at introducing the Productivity Commission, but perhaps in your words, how do you see the role of the Productivity Commission?
Well, sometimes I describe it as the government's think tank. So really our job is to provide independent research and advice to government on policy questions. And our name is the Productivity Commission, so everyone sort of thinks we're just narrowly economic policy, but we're actually much broader. We also span social policy, environmental policy. So really any kind of hard policy question the government's grappling with, they can send our way. We're set up to be independent, so we can provide answers to government that are not necessarily politically convenient, but we think are in the national interest. The government doesn't have to take them on board, but in my view, it's always been a really positive thing that at least, governments have high quality policy analysis in front of them when they're making important policy decisions.
Yeah. And so you started with the Productivity Commission, I believe, in November 2023. What are your priorities for the commission?
So when I started, my kind of overarching priority was really that the commission's work was as relevant and impactful as it could be, so that we were kind of asking topical policy questions, putting important answers in front of government, but then kind of advocating for them to get picked up, because ultimately I'm about better policy in the national interest, so I want governments looking at and picking up our work. We also kind of went through an exercise of thinking about what areas we might like to play in or prioritise. We had been a very, very general organisation previously, so we've narrowed things down to a sort of set of research streams. So we're looking at productivity, probably not surprising to your listeners, but also trade and industry assistance, energy and climate, data and digital, water and environment, and outcomes for First Nations people. And we think that they are big, important policy issues that aren't going away anytime soon. So that is where we're sort of dedicating our research activities.
Right. And this is the obvious part, and this outs me as perhaps not being an economist, but having waded ankle deep into the waters. What is productivity? How do we measure it? And can you tell us a little bit more about it at a very general level?
Sure, I think it's probably the most misunderstood, one of the most misunderstood terms, certainly in the economics lexicon. I did have the editor of Australia's major business paper say to me, if you put productivity in the title of a newspaper story, readership falls 50%. So it's something that makes people's eyes glaze over. But very sort of simple bare bones, it is just the amount that we produce for a given level of inputs. So you'll hear me talk a lot about labour productivity. So you can think of that as the value of what is produced per hour worked. And so you can imagine that, as companies find different and better ways to make things, or they develop new and better products, that all feeds into better productivity. And from a really long-term perspective, I like to say, well, why is it that the average Australian today has about four times higher incomes, capacity to buy more goods and services than the average Australian in 1950? And that's because we've had economic growth powered by productivity over that period. So productivity is actually what drives improvements in our material well-being.
Right. And so it's quite common in those newspaper articles when I've not already been sent off to sleep by the title that it's talked about as good and bad. But is productivity ever really solved? Or is it really a relative measure, or is it an absolute measure? How should we think about productivity in that way?
It's never solved, and really, you'll almost always hear me talk about productivity in terms of growth, how it's changing over time. And that goes to the living standards point. If we want each generation to be better off than the last, we need to continue to grow productivity over time. And that might sound hard and scary, but this is ultimately just about technological improvements, which we know kind of come in waves over time, and kind of constantly iterating better ways to do things. So if we want to continue to see generation on generation progress in living standards, we've got to continue to eke out these productivity gains, which see productivity growth continue.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that, but that makes a lot of sense. I'd like to get into the main course now, if you like, Danielle, which is, of course, this wonderful research paper that your team have put out around housing construction productivity. And perhaps we could start by just going through some of the key findings. As I understand it, the headline message from the research paper is that over the last 30 years, productivity in housing construction has gone backwards by around 12%, where the rest of the economy aggregated has improved by around 49%. Could you unpack those two figures a little bit for our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. And in my mind, it was a pretty extraordinary finding to see a sector go backwards over such an extended period of time. So the housing construction measure, which is a measure that we've developed using the ABS national accounts measures, the challenge is there's no sort of single measure of housing construction. So we've had to sort of pull together various components of the broader construction sector to come up with a proxy for housing construction. But what we find is essentially that gross value added, the amount that the value add of the sector per hour worked, has declined 12% over the 30-year period. And so that's adjusting for the fact that houses are bigger and better quality than they used to be. We actually also include a measure of physical productivity in the report, which is just how much house per hour worked. And we find that that's declined actually by over 50%
Well,
over 30 years. Yeah, which is extraordinary. So we built half as much house per hour than we did in the mid-1990s. But when we do that adjustment for the fact that houses are bigger and better quality, we get the 12% figure that you talked about. The other figure is comparing to the economy as a whole. We can do an aggregate measure of gross value added per hour worked, which you can really think of as just the sum of all of the sectors of the economy combined. And that, as you say, has increased by almost 50% over 30 years. And that's the normal way of things. We normally expect to see improvement in productivity over time. We generally get better at stuff over time. It's just that housing is the exception in this case.
And I've had the pleasure of going through your report, and for listeners, I'll point out now that there'll be a link included in the show notes here, so you can go and download this. This is obviously a free resource provided by the Productivity Commission on behalf of the Australian government. ABS, as Danielle mentioned, is the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It's a wonderful organisation that provides a whole bunch of data that's relevant to all of the things we're talking about today. So, in that report, Danielle, you stake out a number of reasons that productivity is poor. I wonder if we could ask you to just go through a couple of the headline ones for us.
Sure. There's a number that we touch on. One is around innovation. And as I said before, changes in technology and better ways of doing things is the key driver of productivity over time. When we look at the construction sector, what we see is relatively low levels of at least measured innovation. We see less R&D as a share of GDP. We see that only 30% of firms are classified as innovation active. They're taking place, they're taking part in innovation processes within their own business. And that's really low. So compared to the rest of the Australian economy, construction sits pretty close to the bottom of the pack on those measures. So that's really important. If you're not innovating, you're not going to be able to drive the kind of productivity improvements that we want to see. Another reason we looked at was the burden of regulation. And it was probably the one real universal that we heard. We did a lot of consultation as part of this report, but the sense that regulation has got broader, it's become more complex, it takes longer to comply with, and that it's kind of putting a brake on the productivity of the sector overall. We heard about workforce issues. They've been kind of very front and center for the sector in recent times. It is worth noting that the workforce has grown relatively strongly over time for construction, but it's going to have to continue to do so because we know that there's a lot of unmet demand. So issues around kind of retaining, attracting apprentices loom very large. Challenges around sort of workforce flexibility. There's very extensive industrial relations conditions, very sort of strict licensing conditions, whole range of things that can reduce workforce flexibility. And then the kind of final piece, which I think was quite interesting to me, was there's just is a sector that struggles with scale. And when we look at some of the measures of market concentration, so we often look at things like the market share of the top four firms. Construction is the least concentrated sector of the economy. Those top four firms have just 12% market share combined. And average firm size in housing construction is 1.5. So 1.5 employees per firm. So this is a super fragmented industry. It's got a very long tail of small firms. And, that seems to contribute to pushing down productivity. There's some great US research that suggests that bigger firms have higher productivity, so higher output per employee. We don't have many of those. They're also much more likely to be innovation active. So when you've got this long tail of small firms that really aren't super productive, aren't innovating, that seems to depress productivity across the sector as a whole. So those were the kind of core reasons that we focused on for this productivity challenge.
Yeah, and it kind of stands to reason at an anecdotal level, ruling out exceptional individuals, that it's hard for a small business of one, on average, as you say, 1.5 persons to be really thinking about, medium to long term R&D, right? Or putting the level of resources towards those kinds of innovation activities, and the money that that would require.
That's right. It's just very, very hard at that small scale.
I found that an interesting fact, the lack of concentration. So certainly, one of the outcomes of the report will not be to break up any of the players in the industry, I'm sure.
That's right. I'm sure the competition regulator and others looking at competition will be relieved to have an industry that they don't have to worry about excess concentration and to be told the problem is exactly the opposite.
If I could make a counterpoint that's shown in Daniel's report, if we took mining, for example, in Australia, the top four companies in Australia account for roughly two-thirds of the market. So just to remind you again, the top four companies in construction account for only 12% of the market. So that really is a very fragmented industry in terms of market share. Danielle, I want to go a little bit deeper here and really try to get inside what this all means for housing and what these findings and what insights this can give us. So, looking broadly across the economy, what is the impact of a poor performing housing sector?
Look, it's an incredibly important question. You have obviously you have a kind of direct impact. Construction in the broad is 7% of Australian GDP, 9% of Australians' workforce. So if you have a sector of that size that's not performing well, that drags the overall economy. But housing has impacts, well beyond, I would say, its direct effect. Because it is, just so central in all of our lives. So I worry from an economic perspective about the impact on economic performance of the country as a whole. And by that I mean, our cities are really these incredible engines of productivity. They draw people and jobs together. They create spillover benefits from having people work together in the one location, which is what economists call agglomeration economies. And if you cannot build enough housing, productivity flows through to supply. If we cannot deliver the housing that we need within a reasonable commuting distance of our cities, then some people get forced to live in other locations around the country where they're probably not going to be able to achieve a job that is as high a productivity. So they lose in terms of their wage, and our country loses because we're not matching them to the job that they would be best in. So it has this kind of broader economic cost that really is why we decided to focus in on it. There's also some, of course, really significant, social issues as well associated with not being able to supply enough housing. We all understand, what a horrendous social issue homelessness is. We have a real challenge in this country of low-income people living in rental stress. And I think, what is a pretty significant source of generational angst with the fact that it has just become incredibly hard for young people to get into the housing market if they want to buy, unless you're on a very high income or you've got some form of parental support. It is now extremely difficult, particularly if you're in Sydney, to get into the housing market. So, and I think that has kind of, broader and flowing social impacts that New South Wales Productivity Commissioner talked about Sydney being in danger of becoming a city without grandchildren. And, I think it's a really powerful remark. And I think it goes to the heart of some of these challenges. If people cannot afford to, live in the areas where their family is, where they've grown up, because we've just made housing so expensive, then that is going to have all sorts of broad social implications.
Yes, and it is interesting to note that this isn't just an Australian phenomenon. I'm reading a book at the moment about the housing situation in the USA, and of course, those, as you call them, engines of productivity that we think about that are basically spread on each coast of the USA, over in let's say Boston down to New York, down to Washington on the East Coast, and then San Francisco down to LA on the West Coast. Both of those markets have become so expensive that people are being driven away from them, and obviously they are the hotbeds of innovation, if you like, in a range of different areas. So it appears a trend that extends beyond Australia and is actually taking over the world, or at least the developed economies around the world. Is that something that you were cognizant of when you were doing the report?
Absolutely. So the kind of the challenges around housing supply and the way that's played out in cities in the world is absolutely front and center, I think, in a lot of housing debates. There are places that have kind of bucked some of that trend. So people will often talk a lot about Auckland in New Zealand, where they sort of boosted housing supply by allowing more upzoning through the centre. Texas in the US, where they've been building a hell of a lot, and a lot of people have been moving in because housing is relatively more affordable. So there are examples of places that have run counter to this trend. But overall, it's a lot of developed countries are grappling with this in their big cities.
And let's talk about cost. It's on everyone's mind, particularly those people that want to get into the market. I've tracked the cost increases in Australia over the past 10 years, and it equates to around about 65% cost increase for construction costs of both detached housing and what we call multi-story apartments here. That's just in nominal terms. That's not been adjusted for inflation. Based on the findings that you've seen in your report, would you expect that trend to continue unless something changes?
I think largely yes. I mean, I expect, and you would see this in your data, there was a spike in cost of a range of inputs during COVID because of supply chain issues, and that's probably eased somewhat. But more generally, if you don't find a way to get productivity growth in that sector, then costs will continue to outpace inflation. So wages will continue to rise if you're using the same amount of labor to produce less output, then you end up with a more expensive product. So I think the crucial thing will be whether the sector is able to turn around this productivity story that we detailed in our report.
Yeah, and these cost increases as well are substantial, of course. The benchmarking that we did showed that, and I'm rounding numbers up here from memory, but that the cost increase of a standard suburban house in the big cities in Australia had really gone up in that 10-year period by about $200,000. I recall 10 years ago or so talking to a range of colleagues who were studying housing affordability. And I remember very clearly at the time that the consensus was that the issues driving affordability or lack thereof were really around property prices at that time. But I think we can see here this lack of productivity as it affects housing construction. A $200,000 increase in that period is really the difference between potentially a family being able to afford a deposit on that house or not.
Absolutely. And it may also mean that that house just doesn't get built. And there's also, a big
Yes.
feasibility challenge for the sector. At the moment, there's parts of the country where people just, essentially won't build apartments because the cost of the build exceeds the market price, even though the market price is really high, as we've just been talking about. So, if eventually that puts a brake on supply, which further feeds through into lack of affordability. So it really it this is an incredibly important issue if we're going to solve the housing challenge that we see ourselves in.
Yeah, I recently learned about a concept by William Baumol, an economist, which he called cost disease. Now, I could certainly butcher this, but I was wondering if you might be so kind as to maybe explain this concept to our listeners.
Absolutely. Good on you reading about BOMO. That's fantastic. So cost disease is the idea that in labor-intensive sectors, where kind of productivity gains via sort of capital augmentation or other sources are going to be hard to come by, over time, costs are going to creep up. And the reason is that other sectors, so let's say, sectors like manufacturing are seeing these productivity improvements. It's allowing them to pay their people more. So wages are rising elsewhere in the economy. In this little labor-intensive sector that doesn't have productivity gains, if you want to keep people in the sector, you're going to have to pay them more to match that wage rise across the economy. And that means that now you're just driving higher and higher costs because you're not offsetting those wage gains with productivity gains. So, Baumol originally used the example of an orchestra, which I think is a really nice example of a inherently labor-intensive sector. You can't get your violinist playing two violins, or you can't run the orchestra if you cut your whole strings section. So, if we want to continue to pay our orchestra players, on par with growth in wages across the economy, orchestras just cost more over time.
Yeah, so I've also heard it used in relation to healthcare, where, for example, with nursing or aged care, where we really don't have too many other solutions at the moment than to sort of throw more people at it. And it's important that we do that. But I guess if that is the basis of cost disease, then that is very much a phenomenon that we are dealing with in construction. How do we treat it?
Look, I am not as sure that it's a bigger challenge in construction. It's clearly part of the story. And even in healthcare, you can think we've had some pretty extraordinary technology developments over time. It cost disease exists when you cannot find ways to augment or improve processes. I would argue that in housing there is scope to do that, whether that's use of digital processes, off-site manufacturing. As part of this project we went and saw a factory where they're putting roof trusses together by robots. I know that you spend your life value seeing these incredible things happening. So I think there is scope for productivity improvements. I think you're right that the sector has suffered somewhat from cost disease over time because we haven't had those productivity gains. But I'm kind of I think it's a lot easier to envisage productivity gains in this sector compared to a sector like aged care or disability care where labor really is the product.
Yeah. No, look, I completely obviously agree with that. And our listeners would have heard many of the other guests we've had talk about what they're doing in this area. But I guess that comes back to the innovation problem that you identified before, and the fact that the industry's sort of sitting at the bottom of the table, as it were. Let's get into some of those solutions, because your report's not just a great exposition of data and analysis, but it also cuts to a couple of solutions that your team and yourself put forward. So in going into those solutions, I'd just point out that, as you pointed out in your introduction, Productivity Commission works across all sectors in the economy. What are the most productive sectors, and what things have we seen in those sectors that we could learn from in construction?
Yeah, it's a great question. In terms of productivity levels, and I said I won't talk about levels very much, but the single most productive sector in the Australian economy is mining. In terms of growth, it bounces around a bit because of investment cycles, but obviously it's got a high value product, which helps. But it's really led the world in terms of tech and efficiencies. We were the first country to have driverless trains, for example, which were on these railroads going out to the Pilbara iron ore sites. So I think, our mining sector has a very good story to tell. When we look at growth, we just did a project kind of having a look at which sectors have performed well when it comes to what we call multi-factor productivity growth, which is really about the way we combine labor and capital together. We saw sectors like business services, where they've really benefited from digital technologies in particular. Higher levels of education in the workforce also seems to have played a role. Goods manufacturing, agriculture, all sectors that have performed well recently. And I think it is a combination of new technologies that have transformed the way we deliver some of those goods and services, better worker training and education levels. And often the regulatory environment can be important too. And as I touched on before, in the context of construction, when we have things that are highly regulated, it can sometimes stifle innovation, particularly if we're in a world where regulation is changing frequently. There can be less incentive to innovate. So, I think those are probably, the features that you see in industries that are performing well in terms of productivity overall.
Yeah. And this may not have been part of your study, but I'm dying to ask. Do we know which are the most productive countries in the world in terms of housing construction, and how does Australia compare?
We could not answer that question, unfortunately, because we hit up against the same data limitations that we had in Australia that led to us kind of compiling this specific housing construction productivity index. We did have some comparisons for the construction sector as a whole, but that's including commercial and civil. Actually, when we did those comparisons, Australia didn't look too bad. We looked against US, UK, Japan, countries in Europe, and what we found is essentially they were all struggling with the same challenge of stagnating or declining productivity. You would know at a more granular level housing. There's certainly examples. I know you like Sweden as an example, with very great penetration of prefab. Japan, I think, is another country that's sort of renowned for more innovative building processes in residential construction. But unfortunately, we were not able to get the data to confirm. But I suspect if we were, those were the sort of countries that might stand out.
I find that quite interesting that that data is not available. I mean, let's be clear, it's just 7% of GDP, and if we throw in the property sector as well, Danielle, which I often like to combine construction and property, we're up around, anywhere between 12 and 14% usually globally for that thing. It's a very large chunk of the world's economy, and for us to know so little about it. Did you wonder about that when you were putting the paper together?
Look, there's a sort of a common system of national accounts. You can always look at construction as a headline. It's because of the way it breaks down sort of trades, which can capture trades in housing and trades in civil and commercial versus, development versus the other components of the building process. So it's not ideal when you are interested in housing. We could maybe encourage groups equivalent to the Productivity Commission around the world to undertake the exercise that we did, and that would give us a nice comparable series if you can get people interested. But there's national accounting is a tricky area, and everyone's got different ways that they'd like the data cut, but ultimately it's really important that we have a common set of standards across the globe.
Yeah, really important. I've been to see some really interesting industries in my time, and perhaps one of the leading ones was aerospace. Had the pleasure of going and visiting Boeing, over in Seattle. I sort of look at an industry like that, and I wonder, can we ever really get to that level in building? Like, how much, realistically speaking, could we shift the dial?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And obviously there are, different sectors of the economy at different points in time. You can see different potential for technology to drive improvements. But I feel like there's probably some a lot of upside for housing construction. So one reason I say that, which goes to our point about the kind of broader regulatory burden. We found it was taking a lot longer to build than it did once, or longer to deliver, I should say. A house or an apartment building. But really interesting to me, and this may not be news to your listeners, but of that time to deliver an apartment building, which could be 5 years, 10 years, up to 15 years or more sometimes for a big development. Often only a couple of years of that is actual building. So there is this, and this is getting captured in our productivity numbers. We're not just looking at the building itself, it's the end-to-end development process. That suggests to me there's kind of quite a lot of potential gains outside of the building process. And then the building process itself, which I know you spend a lot of time thinking about, there are examples of innovation and doing things differently that you could imagine. If we can deal with some of the tricky challenges around scale, around kind of industry acceptability, you can see improvements in construction too. So I can see, potentially a lot of potential to eke out productivity gains in this sector. It may not be Boeing, but I think there's a lot of scope to do better.
Yeah, look, I want to just also go on the record as saying we completely agree with that. In fact, we've done several studies where we've looked not exclusively at the construction phase of that life cycle of building, but more at the front end with development and design. And we've shown on occasion that we can get improvements of anywhere between 40 and 80%.
Wow.
In those phases,
Yeah, that's
yes.
extraordinary.
And
That's a lot of low-hanging fruit,
exactly,
Matthew.
that is a lot of low-hanging fruit. And for those out in industry who are interested in grabbing that, that's a lot of value that's sitting on the table there. So, but sort of coming back squarely now, before we get into the recommendations themselves, about what then should be the focus to solve housing and the issues that we're facing here. So I'm going a little bit beyond simple productivity. Not that productivity is simple, but the measure of productivity itself. Do we just need much, much more housing, i.e. more supply, or do we need to make that housing much less expensive? Or do we need to do neither of these things as long as we're doing whatever we're doing more productively? What gives us the biggest bang for our buck there?
I mean, so we need more supply to make it more affordable. And productivity helps generate more supply. So if we were able to produce things at lower cost and in less time, that makes more building feasible. That brings online greater levels of supply, which helps with our affordability challenge. So these things are, deeply interrelated, and I would argue kind of a virtuous circle. Almost, if we can address this productivity problem, alongside that, you have to remove, binding constraints on supply. So things like very strict planning regulations, for example, if they're imposing a constraint, those need to be looked at as well. And indeed, we know there's a big process going on in some of our biggest states to do that. But the productivity issue is very core to this as well.
Yeah, but look, I've heard the current housing construction problem that we have referred to as a market failure. Now, I'm not qualified to say one way or the other whether that fits the definition or whether that's appropriate or not. But one of the things I have observed, and this interrogates a little bit more the argument between supply and cost, is that our industry appears to just stop building when it can't increase its price. So, how do we think about scale reducing price? I mean, I can see how that would work in the rental market, Danielle. Like, more supply means downward pressure on the variable rates that we call rent. But when it comes to actually building a new building, we actually see, as you said, earlier in our interview, buildings not coming out of the ground because it doesn't stack up or it doesn't pencil, as they like to say in the US. I mean, does that qualify as a market failure in this way?
No, I mean, I would say that's, it's very normal market behavior in the sense, I mean, you've got to remember people are interested in margins, and margins have two ends. One is the price, and one is the cost. And
Yes.
if you are able to shift the dial on the cost, which is exactly what we're talking about, then you can maintain your margin even in a world where prices are lower. I mean, housing also has this very interesting dynamic, of course, that we've got a stock of existing homes. We're talking about the flow of new homes, and those things are interrelated as well. But all the evidence that I have seen is that, over time, if you can address this supply challenge, if we can make it lower cost to build, therefore continue to add supply. Even in a world where prices are coming down or not growing as fast, then you help address that affordability challenge.
So I think it really would be great now to turn to the recommendations. We've already covered a few of them off obliquely, but I think it would be great to come at them a bit more frontally. Can you maybe skirt us through a few of the recommendations, Danielle?
Yeah, so I mean, there's sort of three broad categories of recommendations, which go to some of the challenges that we're talking about before. The first was around the regulatory burden. So we're really focused on the importance for governments of streamlining burden as much as possible. So looking at the kind of stock of regulations and trying to reduce the load and complexity. And there's some governments doing cool things around, AI, first pass assessments of planning applications. You can employ technology to try and reduce regulatory burden as well. Also, some other states doing things around what we call kind of coordination bodies, so helping developers navigate all the different regulatory processes, helping intervene if things get stuck along the way. So, finding ways to overall reduce that burden of end-to-end regulation is really important. We look specifically at the National Construction Code as part of this work, and we recommended a review of that. That code's been around since 2011. It's a national performance-based code, which is great, but there are certain challenges that emerge from our work about how it was working and delivering that we think would benefit from a closer look. So that was sort of one category of recommendation. Second, we looked at innovation, and as we said before, this is an area where, I think if you're going to unlock productivity gains over time, we're going to need to see improvements in investments in innovation in this space. This is, and I should say, when I say recommendations, I'm focused on what government can do. We make recommendations to government. Government and innovation is always a tricky one. But we look to areas like agriculture, where there's some similar challenges in terms of a really fragmented sector, but they have quite a healthy innovation ecosystem. And I know you've thought about some of this before as well, Matthew, but they have good systems to capitalize on research efforts in universities and other research bodies to actually learn about how we respond to pests, or how do we employ technologies like drones, and then there's government bodies, government activities called extension services, where people actually go out and meet with individual farms and farmers and tell them about some of this kind of best practice innovation to actually get it in front of people that would not have the time and resources to certainly to do that innovation, but even to learn about that innovation. And that's been a sector, which has been good adopter of new technology and has had some pretty good news to tell in terms of its productivity performance.
Yeah, definitely. The regulatory issue is an interesting one. Some of our listeners may not be aware of this, but if we could sort of wind back the clock about 6 years, the big issue that we were all worried about in building were the so-called defects crisis. There was a series of fairly spectacular failures in building, cracks appearing in very large high rises. There were a couple of examples of the cladding on building catching fire and causing damage and in some cases loss of life. We saw that most notably, obviously, in the Grenfell Tower tragedy. So this was a very big part of the discourse around building and innovation and regulation. How do we balance that kind of regulatory review and the layering and the burden as we've been discussing in line with some of those safety and consumer benefits?
Yeah, look, it's important that you raise that. And this is never going to be a sector with no regulation. I think that is really important to say. There are safety challenges. It's consumers buying a long-lived product where, there are what we call asymmetries of information. They don't have as much information as the builder and developer does. So there will always be a need for regulation in this sector. What I find challenging is that it's the layering of different objectives well beyond safety and consumer outcomes. If you're looking at the kind of end-to-end building process, there's going to be regulations and rules around, livability and amenity and heritage and traffic and environmental standards and endangered species and energy efficiency and disability access. And all of those, of course, are very worthwhile objectives, but they come with trade-offs. And, I think we have sometimes ignored the trade-off is to make housing harder to deliver and more expensive. And, cumulatively, that has contributed to getting us to the place we are in now. So I think it's kind of thinking about each piece. We've added things recently that, haven't cleared a cost benefit analysis hurdle. So being, really careful and wide-eyed when we're making decisions to add to the mix and thinking about what perhaps we can take away. And as I said, there's a bigger piece as well about just, working to make the existing regulatory burden easier to navigate from a developer perspective.
Yeah, definitely. There's always work that can be done there for sure. Before we move to wrap up, I'd really like to get your view on what the do nothing scenario looks like here and whether that is indeed the biggest threat or whether there's something else lurking beneath the surface, as it were, in relation to productivity and housing construction?
Look, I think if we do nothing, we just get more of the same. You do the same, you get the same results. This has been a slow burn issue. It's been building over decades, and I think, we end up with increasingly unaffordable housing. Not enough supply, prices continue to rise, and alongside that, an exacerbation of the issues I've talked about. Generational fragmentation, an ever-growing economic costs as young people are kept out of housing markets in our major cities. So, I think the kind of do nothing is not a pretty scenario.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I just want to say again that it's been an absolute pleasure to read the report. We were so happy to see it arrive. We weren't actually aware that it was coming, and so when it did come, it came as a very much as a gift. So I want to thank you and your team, Danielle, for today, especially coming on to be interviewed. As always, our notes and references will be added online to the show notes. I want to thank you again, Danielle, and I want to thank our audience for listening.
Thank you for having me, Matthew, and thank you for all the work that you do.